This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ ضَرَّاءَ مَسَّتْهُ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السَّيِّئَاتُ عَنِّي إِنَّهُ لَفَرِحٌ فَخُورٌ إِلَّا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: tensions on the rise in northern Syria. Turkey is preparing to carry out new attacks on border areas hours after its airstrikes killed three Syrian soldiers in Aleppo. A delegation of European diplomats visits Gaza to assess the humanitarian situation days after Israel's deadly bombing campaign against the besieged territory. And also in our headlines, North Korea fires two cruise missiles towards the sea as Seoul says talks with Pyongyang should contribute to establishing peace. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Turkey's military is warning citizens in northern Syria to stay in their homes as Ankara gets prepared to stage an attack. Local Syrian sources say the strike alert comes as Turkish drones and troops have been deployed to border cities in Aleppo Governorate. Turkey has ramped up its attacks on Syrian border cities recently. Three Syrian military personnel were killed and six others injured in Tuesday's airstrikes on the outskirts of Aleppo. Syrian military sources say the strikes are part of Turkey's long-running efforts in support of terrorist groups in the country's north. Damascus has responded by targeting Turkish bases and armed groups inside Syria. It has vowed not to let any attack on its army positions go unanswered. Elsewhere, over a dozen European diplomats have visited Gaza to assess the humanitarian situation in the blockaded coastal territory following the recent Israeli military aggression. We have more details in this following report by Asher Shannon, our correspondent in Gaza.
Diplomats from the European Union, including heads of European diplomatic missions in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, arrived in Gaza Tuesday morning. The senior European officials toured the Shati refugee camp upon arriving in the blockaded territory. Their short visit comes less than 2 weeks after the Israeli regime launched a three-day military aggression on Gaza that claimed the lives of 49 people, including 17 children.
We come here only 10 days after the ceasefire has been agreed. A ceasefire which gave end to 3 days of terrible fighting, where far too many civilians, far too many children and women lost their lives. It's also to show solidarity to the Gazans in general, but also to the kids, the children who lost their lives, who were injured.
The ambassadors of the European Union made an inspection tour of the wounded during the recent Israeli aggression at Gaza's Shifa Hospital.
We briefed the European delegation on the humanitarian situation in Gaza and the dire condition of hospitals. The delegation also visited the patients and those who were injured during the recent Israeli military aggression. We also told them about the lack of medicines and hospital supplies because of the Israeli blockade.
The brief visit by the European diplomats comes at a time when the people of Gaza are suffering under a tight Israeli blockade that has been in place since 2007. Most Gazans rely on handouts to survive, and many of them are unemployed.
It's clear that many more people fell below the poverty line. Unemployment rate has significantly increased. Health and education problems have become even more problematic.
Palestinians and human rights groups have repeatedly slammed the European countries for their failure to take an action aimed at ending Israeli violations against the besieged territory. Many here believe that the visit by the European diplomats will not improve the situation for the people of Gaza, given Israel's impunity and the failure of the international community to hold the regime accountable for its crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The United States says it's studying Iran's response to the European Union's proposals for the revival of the 2015 nuclear agreement.
We have, in fact, received Iran's comments on the EU's proposed final text. We have received them through the EU. We're in the process of studying them. We are, at the same time, engaged in consultations with the EU and our European allies on the way ahead.
Iran has already submitted its own assessment of the proposals to the EU. Tehran is now awaiting the bloc's response, which acts as a coordinator in the talks for the revival of the nuclear agreement. Iran's foreign minister has earlier said that he sees no obstacle to a deal if Tehran's red lines are respected. According to Hossein Amir Abdullahian, Tehran expects Washington to step forward with a realistic approach and more flexibility if it's serious about finalizing the deal. Still, he says Iran will put its plan B into action in case the talks end inconclusively.
They talk about plan B. We also have our own plan B, but we believe that in the end, this matter should be resolved with the realistic approach of all parties through negotiations.
The European Union has proposed what it calls a final draft for the revival of the 2015 agreement. The U.S. sent the deal into limbo after withdrawing from it in 2018 and bringing back sanctions on Iran. Talks have been held among the remaining signatories in Vienna since April last year to salvage the accord. Abbas Aslani is a research fellow at the Center for Middle East Strategic Studies in Tehran. He explains Iran's stance in the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal.
The administration has been saying that its foreign policy does not rely only on the JCPOA. An Iranian president in his first press conference said that Iranian foreign policy under his administration will not start from the JCPOA, and it will not be limited to the nuclear deal. It means that Iran also sees other alternatives and options in order to improve its foreign relations with other countries. And we have been seeing that in the past, let's say, months or in the past year, in the tenure of the current Iranian president, Iran has been trying to engage in economic cooperation with neighboring countries or regional countries and to somehow find opportunities for more trade, let's say, engagements with other countries. In case that there is no agreement, Tehran, what is arguing is that it will try to continue to find new opportunities independent of the nuclear deal. However, it will not ignore this chance of the negotiations in order to lift the sanctions. There's the argument that the nuclear deal or reviving the deal is not the, let's say, the panacea to the problems in the country. But what is needed is the, trying to find those potentials in order to increase the level of, let's say, trade volume with other countries.
1 year has passed since the fall of Kabul to the Taliban and the end of the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. Since then, the country has been facing major problems, which have caused serious difficulties for the Afghan people. Rahmatullah Bahman reports from Kabul.
Mid-August this year marked the one-year anniversary of the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan and the U.S. massive withdrawal from the country. after 2 decades of military presence. The last year U.S.-led evacuation turned violent and tragic, during which many Afghan people lost their lives. Sports champion Muhammad John, who was shot dead at the Kabul airport, was one of the victims. His parents blamed the U.S. for the tragic incident and are seeking compensation for the loss of their boy.
The U.S. and its allies are 100% to blame for the martyrdom of our beloved ones at the airport because they invited people and gave them hope of getting them out of Afghanistan. The U.S. not only did not provide the people with security, but also opened fire on them. They killed and injured at least 400 people, including my son. We are waiting for compensation from those who committed the crime.
The U.S. 2-decade invasion of Afghanistan ended with the withdrawal of the last U.S. troops from Kabul last year. However, Afghans say Washington has started another war against them, a dangerous economic war. Since the Taliban's return to power on August 15, 2021, the U.S. has frozen nearly $9 billion in Afghanistan foreign reserves and cut off major international funding. The sanctions have pushed Afghanistan's economy to the brink of collapse, with 97% of Afghans living in poverty. Afghan people and international bodies have been calling for the release of funds so that the country could cope with the ongoing humanitarian crisis.
The impacts of the U.S. seizure of Afghan assets have not been less than the damages of their 20-year war. When the U.S. sanctions were imposed on Afghanistan, the fragile economy started to shrink. Banking system crashed and people went out of cash. The money they had on their hands lost its value. Today, 1 year on, the conditions are deepening, so the U.S. and the international communities are obliged to unfreeze the assets and let the flow of aid to the country.
Meanwhile, violence and bloodshed have continued under the Taliban. The country saw a rise in deadly attacks against the Shia community last year, mostly carried out by the Daesh terrorist group. 1 year into the Taliban's return to power, Afghans are still grappling with multiple crises. However, they are happy that the U.S. occupation of their country has ended. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Moving on to the latest developments from the Korean Peninsula, with reports of North Korea firing 2 cruise missiles towards the sea. South Korean Defense Ministry says the 2 missiles were launched off the country's west coast. So far, no confirmation from Pyongyang. North Korea has been working on its nuclear program despite UN sanctions in recent years. Pyongyang argues that it needs nuclear weapons for self-defense purposes. It's opposed to an irreversible denuclearization, viewing it as a breach of its sovereignty. Just hours before the launch, South Korea's president called for talks with the neighboring North. He said any future dialogue should eventually bring the two sides closer to peace rather than being just a political show. We were joined by our correspondent in Seoul, Frank Smith, a short while ago. He gave us his insight on the future of the inter-Korean relations. Let's listen in.
Well, I think for there to be a breakthrough in terms of inter-Korean relations, there needs to be progress between the U.S. and North Korea. It's the U.S.-backed United Nations Security Council sanctions that you refer to. That's really going to be an ongoing sort of intractable stumbling block in terms of getting North Korea toward negotiations over its nuclear programs or some type of arms control mechanism in place. Certainly under a conservative president here in South Korea, it's unlikely to see the kind of initiatives that we saw from previous President Moon Jae-in that organized the engagement and the summits that took place between the North and South and even between the U.S. and North Korea. So it's likely we're going to see kind of a tension on the Korean Peninsula as kind of the status quo for at least the foreseeable future in the Yoon Suk-yeol administration here.
Sri Lanka's government says it will not extend a state of emergency imposed to control anti-government protests as the circumstances have stabilized. Emergency regulations allow troops and police to arrest and detain suspects for long periods. The state of emergency has been widely criticized by rights groups as it allows the president to make regulations and limit the freedoms of citizens without judicial review. The country's new president, Ranil Wickremesinghe, invoked such rules shortly after his predecessor fled the country and resigned last month when thousands of protesters overran his official residence. The country has seen months of protests over acute shortages of food, fuel, and medicines. Kenya is bracing for a legal battle as opposition leader Raila Odinga has challenged the presidential election results, which saw incumbent Deputy President William Ruto as winner.
What we saw yesterday was a travesty and a blatant disregard of the Constitution and the laws of Kenya by Mr. Chebukati and a minority of IEBC commissioners. The law does not vest in the chairperson the powers of a dictator to rule the IBC unilaterally.
Odinga, who was in his fifth bid for presidency, refused to concede, saying the country's democracy has suffered a setback. He also vowed to pursue legal means to challenge the decision of the Election Commission. Ruto was declared victor with some 50.5% of the ballot, but more than half of the commission refused to endorse him. Moments before the announcement, scuffles broke out in the vote tally center. In Odinga's strongholds, namely the cities of Kisumu and Nairobi, protesters also battled police and burned tires overnight. The East African country was hoping for an orderly transition of power after almost a decade under President Uhuru Kenyatta, but concerns about vote rigging linger as such disputes in the past had spiraled into bloodshed. In Tunisia, a new constitution has come into force after the Electoral Commission approved the final results of last month's referendum. The commission says almost 95% of the votes were in favor of the new constitution. The turnout was, however, low. Only 31% of the electorate took part. The new constitution expands President Reis Said's powers while reducing those of parliament. Opponents of the president say the new constitution will unravel Tunisia's democratic gains from the 2011 revolution. Said and his supporters have said the political system needs to change to save Tunisia from years of stagnation and political paralysis. The last French soldier has been expelled from Mali, ending nearly a decade of military disaster and humanitarian catastrophe in the African country. The new government in Bamako has refused to even allow a French ambassador to return, causing many to wonder if the era of French neocolonialism has begun its ending. Rami Mazari has more from Paris.
The last French soldiers have left Mali after being expelled by Bamako following 9 years of unpopular war, which has left Mali one of the poorest countries in the world. 2.5 million refugees have been created, thousands of civilians were killed, and the politicians who initially colluded with Paris, widely accused of corruption, were ousted by popular anti-French protests in 2020.
Malians have been dying for 9 years. Things have only gotten worse. It has spread to Niger, Burkina Faso, Mauritania, and elsewhere. After 9 years, this hasn't worked, and Malians want results. However, when Malians made their revolution, France criticized and opposed it.
The roots of the Mali conflict run deep, but they all feature French aggression. In 2011, Nicolas Sarkozy illegally dropped 40 tons of arms to help overthrow the Socialist People's Libyan Arab Republic led by Muammar Gaddafi. Those arms spread to northern Mali, where the nomadic Tuaregs used them in their conflict with southern Mali, which has existed ever since imperialist France drew Mali's irregular bowtie-shaped borders. Paris alleged the Tuaregs were religious radicals, and in 2013, François Hollande invaded Mali prior to receiving the approval of the United Nations. Many allege that uranium deposits, which keep French nuclear power cheap, gold mines, and the desire to maintain the neo-colonial system known as France-Afrique were the primary motivations for a war which would be dubbed France's Afghanistan.
Many of France's former colonies gained their independence in the 1950s, but since 1960, France has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa.
France has been completely wrong about so many things, and especially the times we now live in. This is a multipolar world, and neocolonialism has failed. Africa no longer wants France and the West as their only ally and as their tutors. Africa has changed, and we will choose our own partners and our own destiny.
The war killed 59 French soldiers, but French imperialism in Mali was cited repeatedly as justification in terror attacks in France, which cost hundreds of lives. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to Thee, to be joyful in worshipping Thee, to be desirous of Thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me Thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom Thou wilt.
The human rights situation has gone from bad to worse in the Persian Gulf island state of Bahrain, which is ruled by the repressive Al Khalifa minority regime of pirate origin, says Kayhan International staff writer in an article published under the heading, "Have the Al Khalifas reached the end of the road?" Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The human rights situation has gone from bad to worse in the Persian Gulf island state of Bahrain, which is ruled by the repressive Al Khalifa minority regime of pirate origin. Bahrain's long-suppressed majority has seen the alarming erosion of its birthrights, with leading religious and political activists imprisoned, along with hundreds of others, including women and children opposing the dictatorial clique, which is supported by the U.S. and is now a client of the illegal Zionist entity. As a matter of fact, the Zionist regime has tightened its tentacles in Manama by opening an embassy and making the Al Khalifa regime to build a huge synagogue in Bahraini capital for the handful of Jews who are not even of Bahraini extraction. This is while the regime indulges in the sacrilegious behavior of demolishing Husseinias and mosques, tearing religious banners depicting the sufferings of the blessed household of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and even trampling copies of the Noble Quran. Aside from its brazen persecution of the Shia Muslim majority, whose prominent religious leader, Ayatollah Isa Qasim, has been forcibly exiled, the regime is now actively collaborating with the Zionists in occupied Palestine by assisting Israeli regime troops in the brutal attacks on Sunni Muslim worshippers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. All this is happening while the so-called advocates of democracy look the other way and feel no inhibitions in praising the butchers ruling Bahrain, such as Britain, the US, and France. Even the calls from human rights bodies based in the West are being ignored by the UN and the North American and West European regimes concerning the prominent prisoners of conscience, such as Abdul Jalal al-Senkis, Abdul Hadi al-Khawaja, Hassan Mushaima, Nabil Rajab, and Sheikh Ali Salman, leader of the Al-Wefaq party who until his imprisonment headed the elected opposition group in the now dissolved parliament. Some of these prisoners, languishing in the regime's dungeons for more than a decade, are in a critical condition due to torture, hunger strikes, and denial of medical treatment. The Al Khalifas seem determined to outdo Saddam of the now defunct Ba'ath minority regime of Baghdad in his reign of terror against Iraq's majority. If they think they can escape the miserable fate of the Ba'athist dictator, who was ironically overthrown by his own American masters, they are in for a rude shock, because the U.S., which has its 5th Naval Fleet based in Manama, is nobody's friend. The moment Washington feels its interests are imperiled, it has a habit of changing its tracks in order to avert a popular uprising that would bring in power revolutionaries opposed to the Americans and the Zionists. In such a case, crafty Uncle Sam would quickly assemble some pseudo-religious and secular elements in the name of a democratic front to replace the ailing Al Khalifas, who would be whisked away safely to the U.S. along with the hundreds of billions of dollars of the country's stolen oil wealth, which is already stashed in the banks of the U.S., Britain, and France, and well out of reach of any incoming government. At any rate, the days of the Al Khalifa regime are numbered, and the onus is now on the Islamic revolutionary elements of the Bahraini society to accelerate their movement for ensuring the identity and independence of their nation by thwarting the devilish designs of the Americans.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Internet Trolls.
Part 3.
The Internet. What began as an exclusive tool to connect militaries, governments, and then universities has now, more than 60 years later, transformed everything about how modern societies operate and communicate. Today, no one can escape the grasp of social media or evade the mind-boggling connectivity that nearly all humans worldwide now have access to. But few have been prepared for what has also emerged with all this human connectedness. A new and ominous strain of human behavior has been unleashed. Increasingly, people are hiding behind a cloak of anonymity, waiting to provoke, harass, and even threaten anyone they choose. They are called Internet Trolls.
A troll is someone devoting large parts of their life to attacking other people on the internet, basically trying to make that other person's life miserable in some way.
They send things to my home. It terrifies me to think what they could do if they wanted to, knowing exactly where I live, knowing where my children go to school.
Trolls can be a minor annoyance or a life-crippling terror. But what happens if society tries to silence them? Who loses then?
Trolling is a free speech issue. And if you aren't free to hate someone, then you're not free.
I've been associated with all kinds of organized trolling groups. We're stretching the bounds of free speech. You either use it or you lose it. Feelings will be hurt.
Politicians and the courts are now grappling with who really is a dangerous troll.
I've been called trolled by very powerful people that should know better. Homophobe, misogynist, racist, all this stuff is just lazy people not wanting to interact.
Artist Gregory Allen Elliott is at the center of a landmark trolling case that might land him behind bars and forever change what any of us, anywhere, can or cannot say online.
If Mr. Elliott is convicted of a criminal offense, watch out. Nobody will be safe. You better shut up. Because if you don't, he could be going to jail.
Gina's blog earns her family a decent income. She writes about being a stay-at-home mom, but from a pro-choice, modern feminist perspective. And a large, active community of like-minded women has grown around her blog.
I like to see that recognition response when someone else goes, oh, me too. And that's so validating. That's why I do it.
Hounding people when they are most vulnerable, like at the time of a loved one's funeral, is a surefire hit for the troll.
That's the easiest way for us to create a mass effect. It's really effective when you have all these people who are already emotional. They got this bomb on them, you know, with the gore photos, maybe some kind of sexually explicit photos. It sends their emotions into overdrive.
But what do the trolls get out of seeing these distraught reactions?
When I used Twitter, I used it as pure form. As an artist, I just went, this is a brush, this is some paint, this is a canvas. I used it to comment on politics. I used it to help people. And I just used it every way possible. One day, I responded to every tweet that came across my tweet stream. And then someone said, you don't have to respond to everything. And I said, I know, right? But today, that's what I'm doing as an artist and an experimenter.
At one point, Gregory was sending 300 tweets per day. He was acerbic, sometimes crude, and very opinionated. Inevitably, he made some enemies who wanted to shut him up.
Mr. Elliott was disagreeing with Stephanie Guthrie's politics. She's the founder of a political organization in Toronto called Women in Toronto Politics. Mr. Elliott was an ally of hers for a number of months. But then there was a break in the relationship because Mr. Elliott stuck up for someone he believed was being bullied by Ms. Guthrie and her friends on Twitter.
Ms. Guthrie, who refused to be interviewed, asked her followers to, quote, sick the internet on a young man who had made an anti-feminist video game, a game that even Mr. Elliott admits was clearly offensive. Internet trolling has two essential parts, the attack and your reaction. A big reaction is what the trolls crave, and the way you respond determines whether or not you are a worthwhile target.
If it's just somebody that's just going to, you know, block us and that's the end of the game, well, you guys suck. That doesn't provide too much entertainment.
Prolific troll Wild Goose and the Wagoner crew are all about the lulls, the laughs their victims provide. They call them lulls cows. So there's a logical limit to how far they'll push them. When the police cannot or will not help, there is another place that trolling victims can turn.
The victims I deal with come to us very frustrated. They're frustrated with the situation because they feel helpless.
Roman Horak is lead forensic investigator at InfoTransec, an international cybersecurity firm. He tracks down the trolls that law enforcement won't or can't find.
The reasons why the police won't engage the case is because they won't believe there's enough of a serious threat, or they won't have, the person themselves won't have enough evidence. Online trolls for hire, the service is available online almost like a hitman. Some of the guys are very professional. They even create their own malware targeted to that victim, so they write their own code. And these guys know what they're doing. These trolls for hire could be pretty much anywhere in the world. Romania or Ukraine, Russia, lots from there. Trying to track them down often becomes an international operation, having to coordinate between different law enforcement in different countries.
But, thankfully, the vast majority of trolls are outright amateurs who don't really know how to cover their tracks. Filled with remorse the night after spewing her online hate, Isabella took to the internet to both confess and say sorry.
I apologized to her, went, look, it is an empty threat, do not worry, I'm sorry. I don't know if it reassured her at all, but kind of it made me feel a little bit better that, yeah, she's getting all these other rape and death threats, at least mine is an empty threat, she doesn't have to worry about me falling through with what I said.
In England, Isabella Sorley's case was a precedent-setting one. A very clear message had been sent by the Crown, but not everyone agrees with the government's stance.
I think trolling is a free speech issue. I think what we have is a situation where people are being prevented from saying certain things, often quite shocking things and not very socially useful things. You know, it's often just insults or abuse. But in my mind, that falls under the category of freedom of speech. And if you aren't free to hate someone, then you're not free.
Brendan O'Neill is editor of the online current affairs magazine, Spiked. He's no stranger to controversy or trolling.
Well, I've been attacked as an individual all the time. I get abuse, I'm defamed, I'm libeled. If I search for myself online, there's all sorts of abuse. And sometimes it becomes physical. So, you know, you get abuse all the time. If you put yourself out there, if you express an opinion, if you say what you think, you will get abuse. But in my mind, that's the price you pay for living in a free society in which everyone is allowed to express their opinion.
Today, opinions are everywhere. But increasingly, tolerance of opposing views is not. It seems anyone can be attacked for saying anything remotely offensive. And the line between internet trolling and what is called public shaming is blurring.
I guess in my definition, net trolls are like a kind of extreme, outrageous minority who will use kind of extreme language. With a public shaming, it's like nice people like us. We tear somebody apart because we're trying to be good, kind, empathetic people. And we're the ones who really do the damage, because being torn apart by like tens of thousands of lovely people like us for a joke that lands badly on Twitter, that is profoundly and horrendously traumatising.
Best-selling Welsh author John Ronson thinks the social media pylons and the public humiliation that many of us take part in daily is out of control.
Take somebody like Justine Sacco, you know, who just before getting on a plane to Cape Town wrote, "Going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white." And she chuckled to herself and pressed send and got no replies. Got on the plane, turned off her phone, fell asleep. Probably the last decent sleep she had in a year.
Justine had only 170 Twitter followers when she posted her now infamous joke. But as she slept on that flight, the internet exploded. When she woke up and turned her phone back on, she discovered that she had lost her job and was now despised by a global audience, with millions of people attacking her online. John Ronson was so unnerved by the public response to Justine Sacco's tweet that he went to see her.
When I met Justine a couple of weeks later, just crushed and broken and mangled up, I asked her to explain the joke, and she said living in America puts us in a bit of a bubble when it comes to what's going on in the third world. I was making fun of the bubble. And then came the trolls. I'm actually kind of hoping Justine Sacco gets AIDS, lol. And you know what? Nobody went after that person that night. We were all so thrilled to go after Justine. You know, we were so happy to be destroying Justine. We didn't have enough space in our brains to destroy somebody who was inappropriately destroying Justine. So that person got a free ride. With a public shaming, you are being told by hundreds of thousands of lovely people that you are worthless. And the people who I met who were really crushed, traumatised, depressed. A smattering of trolls may have said, "We're going to rape you and kill you." But what really killed those people was our righteousness.
The line between bad behaviour and trolling is blurring. And as Britain's most notorious troll, Isabella Sorley, has found out, the consequences are profound. She spent 12 weeks in jail for sending 6 threatening tweets after a night of binge drinking.
20 minutes is still defining my life, which, again, I struggle to cope with that because it was such a short period of time, and I'm always going to have that stigma attached that I'm the Twitter girl.
She's sorry for what she did, but she's not sure the punishment fit the crime.
I think, obviously, what I sent, if you'd said it face-to-face, you're going to get in problem. I don't think I would have got prison. I was definitely made an example of because of how high-profile it was.
Isabella would like to apologise to her victim face-to-face one day, But a lifetime restraining order means that likely won't happen. Today, she works with youth to educate them about the dangers of alcohol abuse, which she believes ignited her trolling behavior. But for now, and likely forever, Isabella will have to live with the very public and criminal consequences of her online actions. Free speech advocate and journalist Brendan O'Neill doesn't mince words. He thinks Britain is creeping closer to a 1984 George Orwell police state when it comes to what can or cannot be said in society. He sees trolls as a scapegoated minority, pawns in a game where much more is at stake.
We present the trolls as powerful and the trolled as these kind of victims. I think it's the other way around. I think troll hunters, usually the media people who present themselves as these brave warriors against offensiveness on the internet, they are the greatest threat to the internet. They are the ones undermining the freedom of the internet, the accessibility of information, the right of people to express themselves. And it's the trolls, the sad man or woman stuck in their bedroom talking rubbish on the internet, they are the victims.
As governments legislate to deal with trolling, there may be unintended consequences for everyone who communicates online.
And my concern with the way in which trolling is discussed today is that everything gets conflated. So you have a situation where trolling can be everything from someone issuing a death threat, which is obviously a serious thing to do, to someone writing an article saying, "I don't think climate change is the biggest problem facing humanity." Everything gets lumped together as trolling. And if you believe in freedom of speech, as I do, you should be outraged by the arrest, not to mention the imprisonment, of someone simply for expressing an idea.
6,000 kilometers away in Toronto, Canada, after 3 years of being forced off the internet, having his artwork vandalized, and wondering if he would go to jail for the tweets he sent, the verdict in Gregory Allen Elliott's case is finally handed down. He is innocent of all charges. The judge says his tweets contained nothing of a violent or sexual nature, and there was no indication that he intended to hurt his accusers.
I was not doing anything wrong, and I was, you know, protecting myself and my freedom of speech, and I wasn't going to be bullied or intimidated by people that were trying to protect the world from bullies and intimidators, you know, for lack of a better word, you know.
Gregory has his freedom, but he's paid a heavy toll for the speech his opponents considered trolling.
The emotional toll is brutal. It's brutal, you know. And the monetary, the money and stuff, I lost my job of 17 years. I had to cash out my pension. Absolutely destroyed me financially. Destroyed me financially.
Gregory's reputation has also been damaged. Even his most abrasive tweets pale beside the trolling he received at the hands of the Twitter mob.
Even though he was in the right, there is a permanent record that's going to follow him on the internet of Mr. Elliott being labeled as a men's rights activist, a misogynist, and a pedophile. And I guarantee you one thing. Nobody who accused him of being those three things is going to apologize.
Gregory's detractors say that misogyny won. And the most vicious anti-feminist trolls see his acquittal as a victory. Tragically, this case has done nothing to make discourse on the internet any better. Meanwhile, back in Chicago, blogger Gina Crossley Corcoran is tired. Despite the validation she gets from her feminist breeder community, the trolls are wearing her down. Constant snarky comments, cruel pranks, threats against her family, and late-night police intrusions. She's learned to manage it, but it's exhausting.
I wish that people would use the internet more as a buffet, just take what you want and leave the rest, as opposed to feeling like anything that doesn't apply to them or anything that they're bothered by is a reason to go on the offensive. You know, when I go to the buffet, I like the chicken and I like the mac and cheese, but I'm not insulted by the other things that are there that are might be useful for other people and other people might find palatable. I'm just like, yeah, those aren't for me, and I walk away. I don't like go up to the manager and scream, how dare you have this available at your buffet? It doesn't personally meet my needs. But I feel like a lot of people on the internet, that's exactly the way that they react.
Will this new psychological phenomenon of trolling ever end? The answer is likely no. Instead, we need to gain the tools to recognize how to fight trolling and recognize how not to become trolls ourselves. Perhaps ironically, notorious troll Wild Goose advocates for anonymity and cautions that our real physical lives should be kept off the internet altogether.
People need to disassociate themselves from their internet persona. I think it's dangerous to sort of plug your personality into the internet. You're leaving yourself open to a lot of dangerous actors, more dangerous people than the Bill Wagner crew. Privacy is just as big of an issue as freedom of speech. They go hand in hand.
We think of our real-world physical lives as distinct from our online activity. But that separation is rapidly breaking down. The biggest challenge we face as we adapt to this change is maintaining our freedoms in the digital space. Freedom of speech may be the most difficult to transition.
For the first time in human history, the masses can express their opinions in a published forum. I think that's a wonderful thing, and my concern with troll hunting is that it's undermining that democratic breakthrough.
Physical threats should never be tolerated, but we may need to ensure that others have the right to disagree with us, insult us, even hate us online.
If we are serious about freedom of speech, then we have to allow people to say hateful, obnoxious, racist things. Freedom of speech covers all forms of speech.
Limelight. Former President Donald J. Trump and his allies have given often conflicting defenses of his retention of classified documents without addressing why he had kept them. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Zolan Kano-Youngs and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled Trump's shifting explanations follow a familiar playbook. First, he said that he was working and cooperating with government agents who he claimed had inappropriately entered his home. Then, when the government revealed that the FBI, during its search, had recovered nearly a dozen sets of documents that were marked classified, he suggested the agents had planted evidence. Finally, his aides claimed he had a standing order to declassify documents that left the Oval Office for his residence, and that some of the material was protected by attorney-client and executive privilege. Those are the ever-shifting explanations that former President Donald J. Trump and his aides have given regarding what FBI agents found last week in a search of his residence at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida. Donald Trump and his allies have cast the search as a partisan assault, while amplifying conflicting arguments about the handling of sensitive documents and failing to answer a question at the center of the federal investigation. Why was he keeping those documents, some still marked classified, at an unsecured Florida resort when officials had sought for a year to retrieve them? The often contradictory and unsupported defenses perpetuated by Donald Trump and his team since the FBI search follow a familiar playbook of the former president's. He has used it over decades, but most visibly when he was faced with the investigation into whether his campaign in 2016 conspired with Russians and during his first impeachment trial. In both instances, he claimed victimization and mixed some facts with a blizzard of misleading statements or falsehoods. His lawyers denied that he had tied his administration's withholding of vital military aid to Ukraine to Mr. Trump's desire to invest for investigations into Joseph R. Biden Jr. and his son, Hunter Biden. When information contradicting that defense emerged in a forthcoming book by Donald Trump's former national security advisor, John Bolton, Mr. Trump's lawyers switched to insisting that he hadn't connected the aid to the investigations, but that if he had, it wouldn't have been an impeachable offense. Of the multiple investigations Donald Trump currently faces, including a state inquiry in Georgia and two federal grand jury investigations, all related to his efforts to cling on to power at the end of his presidency, as well as civil and criminal inquiries in New York related to his company. The federal investigation into his handling of sensitive documents taken from the White House has emerged as one of the most potentially damaging. A search warrant made public on Friday, 12th of August, revealed federal agents had recovered top-secret documents when they searched Donald Trump's Florida residence earlier in the week as part of an investigation into possible violations of the Espionage Act and other laws. Among the 11 sets of documents taken were some marked as classified, or TSSCI, shorthand for Top Secret Sensitive Compartmented Information. According to an inventory of the materials seized in the search, those types of documents are meant to be viewed only in secure facilities. The inventory of documents included other material, some described as confidential. The stunning revelation made clear the gravity of the Justice Department's inquiry months after the National Archives and Records Administration said it had discovered classified information in documents that Donald Trump had held onto after leaving the White House. "What he doesn't have the right to do is possess the documents. They are not his," Jason R. Barron, a former director of litigation at the National Archives for more than a decade, has said. "There should be no presidential records at Mar-a-Lago, whether they are classified or unclassified, or subject to executive privilege or subject to attorney-client privilege. Documents covered by executive privilege are meant to be kept within the government." A spokesman for Donald Trump did not respond to a message seeking comment. Donald Trump used Hillary Clinton's mishandling of classified material, as seen in the Justice Department investigation into her email practices in 2015 and 2016, as political fodder during his first campaign. He is considering another national campaign for 2024, and questions about whether he mishandled the nation's secrets could be problematic for him, even absent an investigation. After officials with National Archives tried for several months to retrieve material from Donald Trump, he turned over 15 boxes of documents in January. The next month, the National Archives confirmed the discovery of the classified information and referred the matter to the Justice Department. Over the following months, officials came to learn that Donald Trump still had additional material at Mar-a-Lago that some of his advisers urged him to hand over. Mr. Trump described the handover of the 15 boxes as an ordinary and routine process. But administrations have been required to turn over documents to the National Archives before leaving office for more than 40 years, as part of the Presidential Records Act that was created in response to President Richard Nixon's attempt to take his documents and recordings with him after resigning in disgrace. Kash Patel, a former Trump administration official, subsequently justified the handling of the documents by saying that Donald Trump had declassified them before leaving office, a claim echoed by the former president this week. In an appearance on Fox News Channel on Friday night, the right-wing writer John Solomon, one of Donald Trump's representatives for interacting with the National Archives, read a statement from the former president's office asserting Mr. Trump had a standing order during his presidency that documents removed from the Oval Office and taken to his residence were deemed to be declassified the moment he moved them. That claim would not resolve the investigation. Two of the laws referred to in the search warrant executed this week criminalized the taking or concealment of government records, regardless of whether they had anything to do with national security. And laws against taking material with restricted national security information are not dependent on whether the material is technically classified.